A jug of house wine arrived with a bowl of warm olive oil and a platter of sliced focaccia, and Joel began eating. Luigi was busy explaining the complexities of lunch and breakfast, the customs and traditions and mistakes made by tourists trying to pass themselves off as authentic Italians. With Luigi, everything would be a learning experience. Though Joel sipped and savored the first glass of wine, the alcohol went straight to his brain. A wonderful warmth and numbness embraced his body. He was free, many years ahead of schedule, and sitting in a rustic little cafe in an Italian town he'd never heard of, drinking a nice local wine and inhaling the smells of a delicious feast. He smiled at Luigi as the explanations continued, but at some point, Joel drifted into another world. Ermanno claimed to be 23 years old, but looked no more than 16. He was tall and painfully thin, and with sandy hair and hazel eyes, he looked more German than Italian. He was also very shy and quite nervous, and Joel did not like the first impression. They met Ermanno at his tiny apartment on the third floor of an ill-kept building, 6 blocks or so from Joel's hotel. There were 3 small rooms, kitchen, bedroom, living area, all sparsely furnished, but then Ermanno was a student, so such surroundings were not unexpected. But the place looked as though he had just moved in and might be moving out at any minute. They sat around a small desk in the center of the living room. There was no television. The room was cold and dimly lit, and Joel couldn't help but feel as if he had been placed in some underground highway where fugitives are kept alive and moved about in secret. The warmth of a 2-hour lunch was fading quickly. His tutor's nervousness didn't help matters. When Ermanno was unable to take control of the meeting, Luigi quickly stepped in and kicked things off. He suggested that they study each morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., break for 2 hours, then resume around 1:30 and study until they were tired. This seemed to suit Ermanno and Joel, who thought about asking the obvious. If my new guy here is a student, how does he have the time to teach me all day long? But he let it pass. He'd pursue it later. Oh, the questions he was accumulating. Ermanno eventually relaxed and described the language course. When he spoke slowly, his accent was not intrusive, but when he rushed things, as he was prone to do, his English might as well have been Italian. Once Luigi interrupted and said, "Ermanno, it's important to speak very slowly, at least in the first few days." "Thank you," Joel said like a true smartass. Ermanno's cheeks actually reddened, and he offered a very timid, "Sorry." He handed over the first batch of study aids, course book number 1, along with a small tape player and 2 cassettes.
"The tapes follow the book," he said very slowly. "Tonight you should study chapter 1 and listen to each tape several times. Tomorrow we'll begin there."
"It will be very intense," Luigi added, applying more pressure as if more was needed. "Where did you learn English?" Joel asked.
"At the university," Ermanno said, "in Bologna."
"So you haven't studied in the United States?"
"Yes, I have,"
he said, shooting a quick, nervous glance at Luigi, as if whatever happened in the States was something he preferred not to talk about. Unlike Luigi, Ermanno was an easy read, obviously not a professional. "Where?" Joel asked, probing, seeing how much he could get.
"Furman," Ermanno said. "A smaller school in South Carolina."
"When were you there?" Luigi came to the rescue, clearing his throat.
"You will have plenty of time for this small talk later. It is important for you to forget English, Marco. From this day forward, you will live in a world of Italian. Everything you touch has an Italian name for it. Every thought must be translated. In 1 week, you'll be ordering in restaurants. In 2 weeks, you'll be dreaming in Italian. It's total, absolute immersion in the language and culture, and there's no turning back."
"Can we start at 8 in the morning? Joel asked. Ermanno glanced and fidgeted, finally said,
"Perhaps 8:30.
"Good. I'll be here at 8:30. They left the apartment and strolled back to the Piazza dei Signori. It was mid-afternoon. Traffic was noticeably quieter, the sidewalks almost deserted. Luigi stopped in front of the Trattoria del Monte. He nodded at the door, said, "I'll meet you here at 8 for dinner, okay?"
"Yes, okay."
"You know where your hotel is?"
"Yes, the albergo."
"And you have a map of the city?"
"Yes."
"Good. You're on your own, Marco." And with that, Luigi ducked into an alley and disappeared. Joel watched him for a second, then continued his walk to the main square. He felt very much alone. 4 days after leaving Rugli, he was finally free and unaccompanied, perhaps unobserved, though he doubted it. He decided immediately that he would move around the city, go about his business, as if no one was watching him. And he further decided, as he pretended to examine the items in the window of a small leather shop, that he would not live the rest of his life glancing over his shoulder. They wouldn't find him. He drifted until he found himself at Piazza San Vito, a small square where two churches had been sitting for 700 years. The Santa Lucia and San Vito were both closed, but according to the ancient brass plate, they would reopen from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. What kind of place closes from noon to 4? The bars weren't closed, just empty. He finally mustered the courage to sneak into one. He pulled up a stool, held his breath, and said the word, "Birra," when the bartender got close. The bartender shot something back, waited for a response, and for a split second, Joel was tempted to bolt. But he saw the tap, pointed at it as if it was perfectly clear what he wanted, and the bartender reached for an empty mug. The first beer in 6 years. It was cool, heavy, tasty, and he savored every drop. A soap opera rattled from a television somewhere at the end of the bar. He listened to it from time to time, understood not a single word, and worked hard to convince himself that he could master the language. As he was making the decision to leave and drift back to his hotel, he looked through the front window. Stennett walked by. Joel ordered another beer. Chapter 7. The Bachman affair had been closely chronicled by Dan Sandberg, a veteran of the Washington Post. In 1998, he had broken the story about certain highly classified papers leaving the Pentagon without authorization. The FBI investigation that soon followed kept him busy for half a year, during which he filed 18 stories, most of them on the front page. He had reliable contacts at the CIA and the FBI. He knew the partners at Backman, Pratt, and Bowling, and had spent time in their offices. He hounded the Justice Department for information. He'd been in the courtroom the day Backman hurriedly pled guilty and disappeared. A year later, he had written one of two books about the scandal. His sold a respectable 24,000 copies in hardback, the other about half of that. Along the way, Sandberg built some key relationships. One in particular grew into a valuable, if quite unexpected, source. A month before J.C. Hubbard's death, Carl Pratt, then very much under indictment, as were most of the senior partners of the firm, had contacted Sandberg and arranged a meeting. They eventually met more than a dozen times while the scandal ran its course, and in the ensuing years had become drinking buddies. They sneaked away at least twice a year to exchange gossip. 3 days after the pardon story first broke, Sandberg called Pratt and arranged a meeting at their favorite place, a college bar near Georgetown University. Pratt looked awful, as if he'd been drinking for days. He ordered vodka. Sandberg stuck with beer.
"So, where's your boy?" Sandberg asked with a grin.
"He's not in prison anymore, that's for sure."
Pratt took a near-lethal slug of vodka and smacked his lips.
"No word from him?"
"None. Not me, not anyone at the firm."
"Would you be surprised if he called or stopped by?"
"Yes and no. Nothing surprises me with Backman."
More vodka.
"If he never set foot in D.C. again, I wouldn't be surprised. If he showed up tomorrow and announced the opening of a new law firm, I wouldn't be surprised."
"The pardon surprised you?"
"Yes, but that wasn't Backman's deal, was it?"
"I doubt it."
A co-ed walked by and Sandberg gave